الحسن. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن، إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن، لعلي وحسين وحسن، لعلي وحسين وحسن. كل من كان محبا لهم، كل من كان محبا لهم، يدخل الجنة من غير حزن، يدخل الجنة من غير حزن. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن، إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن، لعلي وحسين وحسن.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will look at the 5 years of the mass exodus of Rohingya Muslims from Myanmar following a brutal military crackdown and their never-ending struggles. And we shall also discuss a new move by the Indian government in Kashmir to give non-locals voting rights in yet another attempt to change the region's demography.
It's been 5 years since hundreds of thousands of persecuted Rohingya refugees were forced to flee their homes in Myanmar following a military crackdown that was described by the United Nations as a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. One of the largest stateless populations in the world, Rohingya Muslims, have been denied justice. And even worse, their hosts Bangladesh and India are seeking their repatriation, even though the UN believes that conditions in Myanmar still aren't safe enough for them to return.
On August 25th, thousands of Rohingya Muslim refugees in Bangladesh's coastal district of Cox's Bazar, which currently houses the largest refugee camp in the world, marked the fifth anniversary of what they call the Genocide Remembrance Day. This day, 5 years ago, the Burmese military launched a sweeping campaign of massacre, rape, and arson against a vulnerable ethnic minority, forcing them to flee. According to conservative estimates, about 740,000 crossed the border into Bangladesh to escape the unutterable horror. About half of the Rohingya refugees at Cox's Bazar are children, and the ramshackle camps are prone to fires that have killed many of them over the past 5 years. The camps are also prone to flooding, especially during the annual monsoon season. Efforts to repatriate them have failed so far, despite Bangladeshi authorities maintaining that their repatriation is the only solution to the crisis. On the eve of the fifth anniversary last week, Bangladesh's Home Minister Asaduzzaman Khan said his country wants to ensure the Rohingya refugees can return to safe conditions in Myanmar. But the UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet, who visited the Cox's Bazar in August, said the conditions in Myanmar still were not safe enough for the Rohingyas to return home.
In the horrifying violence that unfolded in Myanmar's Rakhine State 5 years ago, thousands of Rohingya Muslims were killed, women were raped, and houses were razed down. Those who managed to escape the violence are now stranded in Bangladesh's Cox's Bazar and some parts of India. The members of the persecuted community are unable to return home while struggling for survival in refugee camps under extremely miserable conditions. Those in Rakhine continue to face systematic abuses and crimes against humanity.
Rohingya Muslims are believed to have migrated from present-day Bangladesh to Myanmar's Rakhine state during the 17th century. When Myanmar won freedom from British colonialism in 1948, the members of the ethnic community were left stranded in the Rakhine state, denied citizenship under the country's 1982 citizenship law, and seen as outsiders. It fueled discrimination against the Rohingya Muslims and exposed them to state-sanctioned persecution and genocide. Their migration continued for several years, but in August 2017, the Burmese junta unleashed a ruthless crackdown on them. The savagery, including gang rapes, cold-blooded murders, torture, and destruction of properties, was widely documented by human rights bodies, drawing global outrage. Soldiers were accused of what many world leaders and rights groups dubbed ethnic cleansing. However, Myanmar's then civilian leader and Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi refused to blame the army. No one was held accountable for the brazen acts of genocide and crimes against humanity. Activists maintain that to facilitate the return of Rohingya Muslims to their homeland, the Burmese military rulers must dismantle the structures of apartheid and discriminatory laws against Rohingya Muslims and stop obstructing international initiatives to investigate what happened in Rakhine.
Now, to have more insights, we are joined by Mrs. Sharifa Shakira, Program Associate at Justice for All, Burma Task Force, and founder of Rohingya Women Development Network from Houston, Texas. First of all, welcome to the program, Mrs. Shakira. Now, it's been 5 years since the genocide and the subsequent displacement of the Rohingya Muslims from Myanmar. Now, can you tell us very briefly how the exodus began?
We, the Rohingya people, have been facing genocide since Myanmar's independence, and it has effectively been going on since 1978. Since then, our citizenship was confiscated from us, our rights on education was confiscated from us, our movement was restricted, our people were tortured, killed, murdered, and all of this, it's been taking place is because of our ethnicity, which is Rohingya, as well as our religion, which is Muslim, and of course because of the land as well. And today, because of the genocide that has been taking place for many, many decades, we ended up living in world largest refugee camp in Bangladesh, with more than 1.1 million people in Bangladesh camp living with living in a limbo with no education, no security, no livelihood, and so on. And we only left with about 600,000 inside the Myanmar, and the rest are everywhere in the world fighting and hoping to be recognized as Rohingya from Burma and to be considered as a citizen and to be given back our rights was confiscated from us, which is our citizen. And we are hoping that one day, inshallah, we can go home as a Rohingya from Burma.
Mrs. Shakira, the UN described the state-sponsored carnage in Rakhine as a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. So how did the military and civilian rulers get away with it?
United Nations neither have the power nor wills to do anything against the genocide by the Myanmar military, informal civilians government led by Aung San Suu Kyi. United Nations could call for international sanctions, but it would not be effective.
Mr. Shakira, Bangladesh wants the repatriation of the Rohingya refugees, while the top UN human rights official says the situation in Myanmar still isn't safe enough for their return. So what can be done in such a situation?
Not only Bangladesh would like to repatriate Rohingya, but Rohingya refugees themselves would like to return home at the same time. And it is equally true that the Rakhine state in Myanmar are not completely safe enough for the refugees to return home. It is because they are two powerful armies, armed groups that fighting each other over the control, which is the Myanmar military and Arakan army. And between both of them, Rohingya inside are becoming the human shells. And it also true that there is no exact information where Rohingya will be settled after they returning home, because their homes, villages was completely erased by the Myanmar government. In these situations, the international community and the world citizens need to engage all the parties involved, including Myanmar military, China, Bangladesh, as well as Rohingya, to find a long-lasting solutions.
On that note, I would like to thank Mrs. Shakira, Program Associate at Justice for All, Burma Task Force, and founder of Rohingya Women Development Network from Houston, Texas. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
George Laria J, Regional Director of UNICEF South Asia, says about 500,000 Rohingya refugee children have been for the past 5 years living in exile in the refugee camps of Bangladesh. Rohingya activist Aung Kyaw Mo reports about demonstrations by Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh to mark 5 years of their mass exodus and to demand safe, dignified, and voluntary repatriation to Myanmar. Jan Egeland, Secretary General of Norwegian Refugee Council, notes that Rohingya refugees were forced out of their ancestral land, adding that history will punish us if we do not make their safe, dignified, and voluntary return possible.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
The controversial move by the Indian government to allow voting rights to non-locals in the contested Himalayan region of Kashmir has drawn anger and outrage from locals who see it as yet another attempt to alter the region's Muslim-majority character. According to the plan, any Indian citizen living temporarily in Indian-controlled Kashmir can vote now, which local population and the political parties see it as a move to permanently disenfranchise, disempower, and dispossess Kashmiris and change the region's demography.
The controversial move was announced in August by the federally governed territory's top electoral officer, riling up local political parties as well as mainland India's political opposition. The decision will see about 2.5 million voters added to 7.6 million voters already existing, marking a massive 30% rise. The new voters would include those temporarily living in the region, including military personnel, government and private sector employees, as well as migrant workers. The decision has been blasted by Kashmir-based political parties and main opposition parties in New Delhi. Mehbooba Mufti, a former chief minister of the Himalayan region and a former ally of the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party, slammed the move as the last nail in the coffin of electoral democracy in the region. She accused the Narendra Modi government in New Delhi of fraudulently bringing 2.5 million voters and applying Israeli policy in the Muslim-majority region.
We are Kashmiri people. To us, Hindu and Muslim make no difference. We always want them to return and stay alongside Muslims. We are secure with each other.
Omar Abdullah, another former chief minister of the region, accused the Modi government in New Delhi of importing voters to win elections. The People's Alliance for Gupkar Declaration, a political alliance of several regional political parties, has termed the decision unacceptable and warned to go to court. Some Hindu parties have also joined the campaign against the BJP government's latest move.
The latest move by the BJP government in Kashmir follows a series of similar measures in the past 3 years since the abrogation of the region's semi-autonomous status in deeply controversial circumstances. Article 35A of the Indian Constitution was central to Article 370, which established the quasi-autonomous relationship between New Delhi and Kashmir and barred non-locals from owning immovable property or exercising political rights in the region. The revocation of Article 370 paved the road for other similar and controversial measures.
Until August 2019, when the BJP government in New Delhi revoked Jammu and Kashmir's special status by abrogating Article 370 and 35A, voting rights in the region were given only to permanent residents. Article 370 of the Indian Constitution barred people from mainland India from permanently settling in Kashmir, buying land, or holding local government jobs there. On August 5, 2019, Narendra Modi's government unilaterally stripped the region of its special status, setting up a series of similar laws that observers say aimed to change the region's demography. Among the controversial moves was the domicile law that grants citizenship rights to every Indian living in the region for more than 15 years, as well as a law that makes every Indian citizen eligible to buy land in the region.
Autonomy is the best option, if somebody would ask me. More autonomy to the people of Kashmir. Fair elections. Send back forces to barracks, number one. Number two, reach out to the separatists, reach out to the youths, reach out to the common man.
Importantly, the decision to grant voting rights to non-Kashmiris comes after the controversial delimitation exercise, which sparked anger and outrage in the region, as Jammu with less population got 6 additional seats, while Kashmir with more population got only 1 additional seat. People in Kashmir saw the move skewed in favor of the Hindu-majority Jammu. According to the 2000 census of the 12.5 million population in Kashmir, Muslims comprised 68.31% and Hindus 28.43%. More than 7 million of these residents live in Kashmir.
Now to talk more on this, we are joined by Dr. Mohammad Junaid. He teaches anthropology at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. He is also a Kashmiri writer whose work on military occupation, politics and memory in Kashmir has appeared in a number of journals, magazines and books. Now, first of all, welcome to the program, Dr. Junaid. Now, the Indian government's decision to give voting rights to non-local Kashmiris has again stirred up controversy and drawn outrage. Now, do you see it as yet another attempt to change the Muslim-majority region's demography?
So, according to Indian election officials in Kashmir, close to 2.5 million Indians who come to Kashmir or who have stayed in Kashmir for a while and decide to vote in the local elections, not the national elections or Indian elections, but the local elections, they will have the right to vote. 2.5 million people is close to 20% of the entire voting population of the state of Jammu and Kashmir. This is a massive shift in terms of how elections have been held in Kashmir over the last 7 decades. We know the history of elections or democracy in Kashmir has always been suspect. There have been rigged elections, people have been chosen or forced to not contest. Now, parties that were close to winning, they were basically forced to accept defeats. The voting agents were tortured and whatnot. And Kashmiris have often lost confidence in the Indian electoral system, because the primary goal for Indian security agencies with regard to elections is not democracy, is not to give voice to the people of Kashmir, but to make sure that they have a pliant regime in power there. So this 2.5 million people that are going to be added overnight to the electoral rolls means that the the ruling regime in India, led by BJP, they will be the beneficiaries, because they are going to make sure that they give voting rights to those people who vote for their party. Now, the ultimate goal is that since 2019, when India revoked the so-called autonomy in Kashmir and did away with Articles 370 and 35A, it needs some kind of endorsement from the Kashmiri public, because the case is in India's Supreme Court, and it wants to make sure that that Kashmiri people are supportive of this. Of course, Kashmiris are not supportive of the changes that took place, but the BJP wants to manufacture that consent now. So that's why they want a pliant regime in Kashmir, particularly led by its own party, that will kind of endorse the 2019 decisions.
Dr. Junaid, Kashmiri political outfits as well as India's opposition parties have condemned New Delhi's latest move in Kashmir. One Kashmiri politician equated it with Israel's policy in Palestine. Now, do you find the parallels striking?
This is happening in the overall sort of context of India trying to take away not only the rights of Kashmiris to their land, but to sort of change the dynamics of the 7-decade-old conflict by kind of forced demographic alteration. This is not new, of course. Globally, it has taken place. Dominant states, settler states, have sought to demographically alter situations for indigenous peoples. By changing the facts on the ground, the Indian government wants to sort of alter the conversation altogether, because so far Kashmiris have been talking about their own sovereignty and the unhealed scars of 1947 partition that left Kashmiris in a limbo. But now India wants to turn it into a sort of a Hindu-Muslim conflict, where the settlers, mostly Hindu from India, would have a privileged existence in Kashmir as compared to the historic population of Kashmiri Muslims and Kashmiri Hindus, which is a small minority of the population, who would sort of be at the mercy of this large new settler population backed by a huge Indian army, which is already kind of present in Kashmir. These tactics are, of course, Indian government officials often talk about this in terms of, sort of making sure that they have a nationalist population in Kashmir. So they're trying to introduce a new population, which is not different from what the United States did, for instance, in its colonies, or what Israel is doing in Palestine, what British did in Australia and New Zealand and so many other places.
Last but not least, sir, is it fair to say that the space for pro-freedom groups and civil society shrunk in the Himalayan region due to India's massive crackdown after the events of August 2019?
So this is a very dangerous new situation that Kashmiris are in. In terms of, the elections, also we have to remember that there has not been an elected assembly. Kashmiri, as I said, they don't vote too much in the elections, but there was sort of an assembly in place in until 2018. And that was dissolved then. It's also interesting because while people are talking about elections, the assembly that might be elected would have very little powers. I know Kashmir is no longer a state now. It's a union territory, and some of the major institutions in the state, like the police, the home ministry, and education, and so many other areas, are directly now controlled by India's federal home ministry. So the whatever body is going to be elected will have very limited say. My sense is that the goal is to have a rubber stamp authority in Kashmir, whose only purpose would be to endorse the August 5, 2019 decision of the Indian government. So whatever elections happen would not alter the situation of Kashmiris. It would simply endorse what is the fact on the ground right now.
On that note, I would like to thank Dr. Mohammed Junaid. He teaches anthropology at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts in North Adams, Massachusetts. He is also a Kashmiri writer whose work on military occupation, politics and memory in Kashmir has appeared in a number of journals, magazines and books. Thank you for being on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Novelist, poet and activist Meena Kandasamy quotes former Kashmir Chief Minister Mehbooba Mufti slamming the move to give non-local Kashmiris voting rights as the last nail in the coffin of electoral democracy in the region. Anis Sargar, a Kashmir-based journalist, reports on the all-party meet called in protest against Indian government's move to allow non-locals voting rights, which has triggered fears of demographic change among locals. Kashmiri political activist Farooq Rehmani terms the move to give voting rights to non-locals in Kashmir as a predetermined settler policy, equating it with Israeli plans in occupied Palestinian territories.
And that was our episode about the plight of Rohingya Muslim refugees persecuted at home and disowned abroad, and also the Indian government's continued attempts to change Kashmir's demography. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss about the problems, questions and issues you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. Today in our studio, we have with us our guest speaker, Professor Salman Naqvi. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you very much.
Professor Salman Naqvi is a faculty member at the Al-Mustafa University and also a researcher on the Islamic issues in the Hawza Ilmi Afkum. So we have been talking about the domains of behavior and the types of relationships. In the previous episodes, we have been talking about the relationship with environment. And you said that when we are talking about the relationship with environment, apart from teaching our children to take care of the environment, we also need to teach them basically how to explore in the universe. And you said that the concept goes beyond science. There is philosophical reasoning that needs to be taught. So how do we inculcate philosophical reasoning in our children?
Yes, exactly. This is a very important thing. We must take guidance from the Holy Quran. As I mentioned, the Holy Verse, that Allah Almighty wants to tell us that everything that you see, what I have created,
I created it for you. It's at your disposal.
I created it for you. It's for your well-being. You have to discover it, you have to harness it, and employ it and utilize it for the betterment of mankind.
Yeah.
Under the umbrella of wilaya.
True.
The Quran says, I want you to discover, when it talks about tadabbur.
Afala tadabburun.
Yeah. In the Quran, it's talking about understanding the signs of
contemplating.
Allah. Contemplating, trying to understand, to discover.
Yeah.
It's philosophical and scientific research going together.
Yes.
I mean, a scientist will look for the cause. The philosopher will say, you're looking for a cause. Why are you looking for a cause? There's something very foundational beyond that, that cannot be proven by experimentation. So those foundational issues have to be understood. For example, when you say, is it possible for this room to be dark and litten together? It's either dark,
or it's lightened up.
Or it's lightened up. Yeah. It can't be together, both of. This is something which we take for granted.
Yeah.
But there's a philosophical understanding of that.
Yeah.
If that philosophical understanding, of course, I'm not talking about the terminology that is employed in philosophy.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the concepts, the foundational concepts that have to be taught to the child. We ourselves have to understand, because look, many of our discussions and disputes go into polemical debates.
Yeah.
Because we do not accept many foundational things. We have to understand and accept those foundational concepts and propositions to be able to build upon those arguments and our reasoning.
Yeah.
The child must understand those foundational issues, so he does not, his thinking and his reasoning does not contradict with that.
Okay.
Contradiction itself is a philosophical and a logical issue.
Okay.
What is contradiction?
Yeah.
Two things of an opposite nature cannot exist together, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
For example, this table in front of us, it cannot be both green and both red.
Yes.
It's either green or it is either
red. Or it's red. Yeah. So that contradictory nature also...
That's contrasting, but we have contradiction.
So that way we are even teaching...
So, I mean, these foundational issues have to be inculcated in our... When we talk about things, when we discuss issues, we discuss, we debate, we should be employing proper reasoning.
Yeah. And that's actually something that may also help our children to come out of hypocrisy, not develop a hypocritic nature. I'll be talking more on that with you after a short break, dear listeners. Stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are talking about how do we teach our children the philosophical reasoning. Professor Nakavi, you told us a very important point over here, that either a room is bright or it's dark. Two things cannot happen at the same time. And something like that is also explained in Surah Ahzab, which the verse says that, in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that, I have provided you with one heart, because one heart contains one rule. Your heart can be either Husseini or it can be Yazidi. It cannot be a Husseini and a Yazidi heart at the same time. Yes.
Exactly. Very good example you have given. Actually, the essence of that philosophical reasoning can be understood in the martyrdom of Imam Hussein also.
True.
And the sacrifices given by the Ahlul Bayt.
Yeah.
It was for the sake of the love of Allah Almighty. They gave that sacrifice.
Yeah.
But love of Allah Almighty cannot be separated and divorced from the intellectual level of understanding that goes beneath it.
Okay.
The roots of our understanding of Islam and the purpose and the mission of Islam is intellectual. For example, when we talk about the sacrifice of Imam Hussein, we want to give a picture that Imam Hussein did it just for the sake of love. It was love. No, beyond that love and beneath that love...
Exists
that,
the intellectual, the intellectual level.
You
logic.
Cannot divorce the intellectual level from the emotional and the spiritual levels.
Okay.
So when we talk about our relationships with Allah Almighty, when we talk about wilaya, when we talk about all our relationships, when we talk about love, compassion, when we talk about emotions and feelings, but the underlying thought process cannot be overlooked.
All right.
And that is, we have to bring about a marriage. We have to make our child understand, look, this love and this sacrifice that Imam Hussein had was based on sound reasoning.
Yeah.
It was based on sound reasoning, and every sound reasoning has a strong foundational basis.
Yes.
And the natural laws of thinking are employed there, are applied there.
Yes.
And without that, you cannot build up that rational understanding.
Okay.
Even the scientific understanding of the universe has this underlying layer of philosophical understanding.
Okay.
And foundational reasoning. So this, if we are able to bring about this sort of understanding in the child through our discussions, through our debates, through our readings, through our interaction with ulama, we have to develop that thinking. And the problem which we are facing today is that children are thinking of science as God.
All right. Oh,
why do we do this? Can science prove that? Can science do that? No. Science
is limited.
Is limited.
All right. So I will talk more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, Raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing, and we're talking about the concept of philosophical reasoning and how we can inculcate this concept in our children. Professor Naqavi, you told us that when we are, for example, teaching our children the story of Karbala, we don't have to just show our children that this was an emotional story, this was just an emotional relationship of Imam Hussein alayhi salam with God, but there was an underlying process that was the philosophical reasoning.
Yes, exactly. When we talk about Imam Hussein and why he did not accept to pay allegiance to Yazid, he gave a very basic, very intellectual, very reasonable answer, very beautiful answer. مثلي لا يبايع مثله. A person of my caliber, of my competency, of my stature, of my a person who has such attributes as me, knowledge and skills and many other things which are required for being the imam, the worthy leader of the society, cannot pay allegiance and bow down to someone who is not worthy, like Yazid.
Okay.
Not only he does not have the qualities to be a good leader, he has negative traits.
Yeah.
And therefore, that is the intellectual understanding. That is the basis that Imam Hussein is to telling us. Look, go for worthy leadership.
Okay.
That is something very intellectual. All intellectual people, rational people of the world will accept that.
Yeah.
Based on that, we need to have a mission statement. We have to introduce a system of governance which is based upon worthy leadership.
Yeah.
Even if a person who is not worthy has a popular mandate, people vote for him, people go out for him.
So Imam is teaching us.
Imam is telling us popularity is not enough.
Yeah.
Popularity is not enough. You have to popular support is important when it is for the competent person. Imam Ali, we have to make our children understand, look, Imam Ali was the imam, He should have been the Khalifa after the Holy Prophet. We believe as Shia Muslims that the person who was worthy of being the successor of the Holy Prophet was Imam Ali because of his worthiness, because he was competent.
And it was even announced.
And it was even announced. The announcement was based on the fact that he was worthy of it.
Worthy, yeah.
I mean, that is the underlying principle that we have to teach our children. Yeah. Competency, worthiness.
Yes.
As I said, even we...
So when you're just
when we obey God because he's worthy of it.
Yes.
So we have to make our children understand, look, you go for caliber, competency. You go for the truth.
Exactly.
حَتَّى يَتَبَيَّنَ أَنَّهُ الْحَقِّ That we show our signs in the heavens, in the souls, to make you understand that Allah is the absolute truth because he's worthy.
Worth of that.
And this is what has to be inculcated in our children.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Professor Naqavi, for being with us and providing us such meaningful information regarding the philosophical reasoning that needs to be taught to children. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you want to listen again, you can go back to our official website. That's www.parstoday.com. You can go to the tab, Call of Islam, and out there you can search Islamic Upbringing, and you'll find all our episodes over there. Thank you so much for being with us once again. And in case you have any questions, you have any issues, you have any... anything you want to ask about the Islamic upbringing of your children, you can feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until another session, fi amanallah, God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illallah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
Reza Khan was not himself perhaps opposed to hold morning session. He was an agent assigned to stop them. He was assigned by experts who knew the issue well. Those were enemies of us, all of Muslim nations. They had studied the circumstances of the nations and knew that they could not reach their aims as long as such mourning sessions and recitation of elegies were held and the cruelties of rulers were revealed and condemned.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. In the name of Allah, we start another episode of the program Spring of Truth. Welcome, my dear brothers and sisters in faith. And if you've been following us, you probably know that in the, you know, these series of programs, we're trying to choose some of the wise sayings of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh and try to offer you an explanation about it, hoping that it would be fruitful for your everyday lives. So the one that I have chosen today is, he says, just as every person, an individual, is obliged to correct himself, he's also obliged to correct others. This is really tricky. You have to think about it in order to know exactly what he means. Because so many people, they focus all their attention on fixing other people, assuming that whatever they're doing is right, and all their attention, all their energy is on other people. On the other hand, some other people believe that they have to focus all their energy and attention on themselves. And they say that, you know, it's a free world. I'll try to do whatever I can do. I'm going to be the best version of myself. And, you know, I don't really care about other people and what they do and how they live. I only care about myself. There should be a balance between the two. And not to be so immersed in yourself and also focusing on yourself at the same time, you know, not being carefree about other people in your society. It's actually what he's trying to say is the idea of amr bil ma'ruf and nahi anil munkar, to order to the right and forbid from the wrong. But of course, this very important principle in Islam has its conditions. And if you want to have an effect, if you want to have an impact on other people in doing amr bil ma'ruf and nahi anil munkar, you have to first work on yourself. I mean, you can't say something that you're not good at. You know, you can't actually order people to what is right when you're not doing it yourself. I remember a beautiful hadith. Someone came to the Prophet and said that, please tell my child not to eat so much dates. And then the Prophet said, not today, I can't do that because I have eaten dates today myself. So you see, there are some detailed and some very sensitive points to the amr bil ma'ruf and nahi anil munkar that you have to keep in mind in order to be effective in what you're trying to say. So if you want to do it, first of all, work on yourself. And don't be an example of the verse that says some people, some knowledgeable people are just like donkeys carrying books where they themselves do not practice upon. Thank you very much for being with us. And wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi.
economic divide.
It is a crisis of mammoth proportions for Europe, worse than inflation, worse than energy prices. Europe is experiencing a kind of drought not experienced in 400 years, and the European economy is taking a further beating as a result. How much pain can Europe experience before it bursts? Hi, I'm Kaveh Tahwai. Those are just some of the angles we'll be looking at in this edition of Economic Divide. Coming up in this program, the European drought, worst in 500 years. 47% of Europe is under warming conditions, a clear deficit of things like soil moisture. How much of a beating can Europe's economy take from that? The European drought's consequences: it has impacted electricity generation, it has disrupted transportation, and it has displaced thousands as a result. And then we will take a look at the European economies. There have been widespread income losses as a result. It appears that no sector is actually spared. Agriculture, financial institutions are just two examples.
Europe is now going through one of its worst droughts in years. Experts believe this is the continent's worst such event in 500 years.
It means that something's changed and something's gone wrong, that we're seeing both heat and dryness like this. So personally, I'm concerned that this is only going to get worse and that the UK is going to have to adapt to hotter weather as we have more and more summers like this.
Major rivers across the continent are also at their lowest levels in years.
Well, we're started our holiday to walk the Thames path, and we started at Thames Head at the start of today's morning, and we haven't found the Thames yet. As you can see, it's completely dried up all the way.
Waterways like the Rhine, Danube, and Po have dried up or have been reduced to trickles.
Online social media posts on this topic were directed at the governments for either not doing enough or for them to not have taken previous warning signs seriously when it came to, like, climate change, for example. And how ironic that climate change actually is not the topic of concern anymore, at least for now, because surviving and weathering out the energy crisis is what people are worried about. All right, let's take a look at our first post. Europe is experiencing its worst drought in 500 years. A staggering 64% of the European Union is experiencing drought warning or alert conditions, including much of England, Italy, Ireland, France, Spain, Germany, and many more countries. Next, we are getting mass murdered by our own governments, enforcing the opposite of an economy. Even as hundreds of rivers are disappearing and our food chains are collapsing, we're being governed by the worst criminals in human history. Next, worst drought in Horn of Africa and China since records began. Worst drought in the U.S. in 1,200 years. Then worst drought in Europe in 500 years. And all of this is happening in the third year of a record cool La Niña. And still most people are oblivious to this new reality. This shows how drought is not just a problem for Europe. And finally, the drought in Europe, 47% of the EU territory is in warning conditions and 17% is in alert conditions. This has serious impact on food production and river transport. Horrific timing when already a food crisis and high energy costs with the Russian invasion, or the Russian war as we call it, of Ukraine is happening. Okay, let me introduce our guest for our first segment of the Q&A. Professor Piero Lionello joins us. He's a full professor of oceanographic and atmospheric science at the University of Salento. He's also the chair of MedClivar, a network of scientists and climatologists focusing on the climate of the Mediterranean region, and also a member of the MEDEC project, awarded Council of Europe's 2020 North-South Prize in 2020, who joins us from Lecce in Italy. Professor, welcome. Given the capacity that you have in terms of your specialty. The drought that's happening in Europe is pretty severe in terms of the intensity and the longevity that we're looking at this point, which is set to persist for a little bit more time. What kind of effect is that going to have on the economies in Europe? And what can governments do to try to deal with this, especially when it comes to people's income?
Yeah, of course, water is an essential good. It's essential for the functioning of human societies. It's essential for ecosystems and for individuals. So lack of water or decrease of water with respect to the regional standards is always a major problem. And there are sectors which are directly involved. The most obvious one is agriculture, but also energy production. And also there are indirect effects on tourism as and on the environment. And the effects are not just on the economy, but also on the cultural and on traditions, as you are actually eventually experiencing. You know that the glaciers in the Alps are experiencing a very severe contraction. Then you can also lose environments and landscapes that are perceived as part of a cultural heritage, as part of a cultural of different countries. So, of course, agriculture is the most affected, and clearly there is a damage. Now, actually, agriculture is not the primary source of income for most of the European countries that are presently affected by this crisis. And maybe I can anticipate some of the other questions that you might pose. And there is a lot of potentials for adapting and contrasting those effects. But in general, of course, they are posing a severe stress on several sectors and on individuals and on human society in general.
Indeed. Obviously, lots of sectors are affected by this. Okay, our next guest is Dorit Mahasne. He's an environment and water expert who holds a PhD in hydrology and marine sciences. And he joins us from Amman, Jordan. Welcome to the program. The current drought has a significant impact on people's livelihoods when it comes to the way that it is affecting their lives, because we're already looking at a strained economy when it comes to Europe, what with the pandemic and, of course, the inflation crisis that is gripping many, if not all, European countries. What kind of consequence will we see in terms of the economic impact of this drought for people's lives?
Well, countries in such crisis, and we have witnessed this year, there is an inflation, lack of water, high temperatures would definitely have a negative impact directly on tourism. And tourism is a very important line in any country's economy. And we're talking particularly on countries that depend on having good weather for tourists to come to, Spain, Portugal, France, etc., and Italy. So that is the first major issue. To add, the heat would definitely affect a lot of production in agriculture, and thus not only tourism, the supply chain would be disrupted.
Time now for our Info News section of the program. This is where we cover news from around the world. First off, let's take a look at income that Russia is generating. That is something that made news, not in the way that you think, however, because many were surprised. Still earning billions from U.S. trade, That's right. It comes in spite of Washington imposing a long list of restrictions on Moscow. Over 3,600 shipments of wood, metals, rubber, and other goods actually arrived at American ports from Russia since the month of February. So there you go. That's how good sanctions are. Next up, something that is plaguing the EU as a whole, recession. In this case, the Eurozone, which is already in a recession, is what this news says. And it says the energy crisis has led to the economic downturn. Nothing new there. However, this is what's important. The Eurozone economy will reportedly contract by